The other theme that is dominant in English literature, as I mentioned, is a sense of loss, of sadness, of something that has disappeared in your life. If you look at English poetry from its early days, from Spenser and Shakespeare through Alexander Pope in the 18th century, the Romantic poets, most famously William Wordsworth, but also Tennyson, and up to modern times, most of it, which is not devoted to love, is devoted to something that once existed, no longer exists. As I say, William Wordsworth, how many of you have heard of Wordsworth? He is one of our three or four greatest poets, and I lived in the valley where he went to school. And his most famous poem is called The Prelude, which is about his childhood, and about once how when he was a young child he used to wander around and have a feeling of all sorts of power in the rocks and trees, a sort of Shinto Taoist feeling. And then as he grew up, as he in his poetry puts it, bars of the prison house grew around me. He felt he was imprisoned in this, what later Max Weber, the sociologist, called the iron cage of rationality. He grew up into being an adult, and all that mystery disappeared. This is the most famous poem about it, but our second greatest poet, John Milton, his greatest poem, Paradise Lost, summarizes this. Paradise, we once lived in paradise in our childhoods, and before we came to this earth, but we have lost it. Or Tennyson, in his great poems, In Memoriam, In Memory, was one of his great poems. That was in memory of things that had been lost. Or even in the 20th century, T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, a lot of this is about the same lingering feeling of loss. And you see it in Shakespeare, in The Tempest, in A Midsummer Night's Dream. And above all, you see it, or equally, in our great children's literature. If you think of, say, the 10 or 15 greatest children's book, and I'm not talking about fairy stories, of which, of course, the Germans and the French have great for children, then from Alice in Wonderland, Beatrix Potter, Rudyard Kipling, Winnie the Pooh, Peter Pan, Narnia, and Hogwarts onwards. This great tradition of English children's stories is the theme of all of them is the same, which is that once we lived in a world which was filled with magic and everything was more meaningful and more real. And now we live in a boring, grown-up world. And nearly all of them try to take you back. Peter Pan never wanted to grow up. And so it's a return to a childhood. And it's very easy to understand that in terms of what I've explained to you, which is that this is the life experience of all these writers. The Wind in the Willows is another example. That they once did live. I went through this experience. My autobiography, which I'm writing, is about this whole thing. You start in a meaningful world surrounded by toys which are half real, half childish. Everything is more than it seems. Then gradually this fades away and you have to become rational, grown up, independent, think about money, etc., etc. So it seems a sense of loss in that way. The dragons, the tooth fairies, Father Christmas, all these things you're told, no longer exist. You are becoming an independent adult. In fact, what I've discovered later, of course, is that life is not as simple as this, a movement, because all of us as grown-ups and adults actually never lose that magical world. But we find it in different things. We find it in music. We find it in novels. We find it in films. We find it in friendship. All sorts of things which are equivalent. But the integration of that early childhood experience in the first 6, 7, 8 years tends to be lost. So, one thing that's worth stressing to you as a Chinese audience and is not known, as you probably, I became interested partly in all of this because I've been looking at comparative education in China and in the West, and why so many of the Chinese middle class are sending their children to be educated in Western schools and universities. And they do this because they have high prestige and they think it's good and it will give them international contacts and all sorts of reasons. Like, hardly any of them ever realise what they're doing. They don't realise that when they do this, they reshape their children into a different kind of personality from the Chinese background. So when my Chinese friends say, is this a good idea? I say, yes, later on. But let your children grow up in China until perhaps at the end of their schooling, and then maybe go to university abroad when they've got their identity fixed and firm here. But many of my friends bring their children over when they're 8 or 9 or 10, and then they are often stranded between two worlds. I now want to move on to another feature of the Anglosphere, which I've touched on. Because the Chinese situation is one, as I mentioned, of structural balance, of harmony, consensus, yin yang, the dominant theme in Confucianism is peace, peaceful resolution of tensions. So this is why your civilization is relatively very, very peaceful. Ours is like this, atomistic individualism. And each of these little molecules, which is an individual with their networks, quasi, quantum, friendships, and so on, is in competition with the others. The basic ethic of our civilization is struggle and fight, is confrontation, an endless attempt to become superior in some relationship with others. This is built into every aspect of our life, and until you understand it, you won't understand the West at all. It's quite difficult from a Chinese Confucian background to understand how important this is. And I can show this by a rather nice illustration. I once wrote a book about the greatest Chinese, greatest Japanese philosopher, social philosopher, Fukuzawa Yukichi. I think I mentioned him. He's on the 10,000 yen note. He's still very important in Japan. And he was the great translator of Western books into China, into Japanese. And he was asked by the Bureau of Translation to translate a textbook on Western economics. And so he did his translation. And he came along and showed it to the head of the Bureau of Translation, who was a Confucian scholar. Confucian scholar was reading it through, so he said, oh yes, very good book. And he came across this two characters, probably Chinese characters, which Fukuzawa had put in. One character meant racing, as in racing against another person, trying to win a race. And the other character meant fighting. Mm-hmm. And this was his translation, which is still used in Japanese, for capitalism and the market economy. And the Confucian scholar said, this is awful, you can't put this, these very aggressive characters in the middle of this book. Please change it to something like the honor and reverence which people have to each other in their transactions and how they feel empathy and sympathy for each other. And Fukuzawa said, that's nonsense. If I change it to that, you don't capture the essence. Capitalism and the market economy of the West is a race and a fight. One person wins, one person loses. If I can't put those characters in, I can't translate it. So, our civilization is based on competitive struggling and surviving. This is why when Karl Marx, I think you probably know of, read Charles Darwin's Origins of Species, which is about competition, survival of the fittest in the animal kingdom, he was enormously impressed. In fact, he asked Darwin if he could dedicate Das Kapital to Darwin. Darwin never replied, which is a pity, but anyway. It wasn't dedicated to Darwin, but Marx commented that Darwin's vision of the animal world, which is fight, 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 survival of the strongest and the fittest, was just a projection of, by Darwin onto the animal world of his own social capitalist world. Nature was mirroring culture and society. And this is what I learned from the beginning of my schooling. As soon as I went away to my boarding school, what I was being taught was that life was a battle or a struggle or a race. Even in the mottos to my two schools, my two boarding schools, though I didn't pay much attention, but they, you have a little phrase which you can capture what you think your children in the school should be pursuing, and you have them in Latin, and the one for my first school was taken from the Latin poet Virgil, I think, and it was per ardua ad solem. And it translates as by hard work and struggle to the sun. You as a little boy from the age of 8 are struggling to get up to the sun. It is a race and a fight to get up there. My second motto was dura virum nutrix, a hard nurse or teacher of men. Only by hardship, this is from Sparta, from Greece, only by hardship, from beating, from suffering, from facing difficulties and overcoming them, will you become a man. So we were taught, our schools are unlike your schools are crazy because you just work too hard, but our schools were crazy in a different way because we didn't do much work, but the rest of the time we were fighting. Now, that doesn't mean we were constantly fighting physically, but sport, every day, every afternoon, throughout my school days, for 3 hours, 2-3 hours, I would go out and I would play often these very, very tough games like rugby, football, hockey, and then gentler games like cricket. When I wasn't playing these hard games for 3 hours every afternoon, I'd spend the rest of my time playing competitive games where I was trying to outbeat my friends in some way. For example, you had a nut on the end of a piece of string, and for 3 or 4 weeks every year, you used to tie these nuts on, and then one of them would hold the nut and the other would have this, and you try and break the other person's nut. This was called conkers. Mm-hmm. Or you would use little marbles and you would try and defeat the other person and get all their marbles. Endless games, competitive games. Now, you may think, oh, well, this is what you do at school, but it invades all parts of our life. For example, our legal system. The whole of our legal system is based on this competitive, argumentative, aggressive, confrontational legal system. In an English court, you're having a trial, you have two lawyers, this is a serious criminal trial, you have two lawyers fighting with each other for their client, whether it's the state or the individual. And they try and defeat each other in front of the jury. So you have a dueling match. It's rather like two Chinese armies meeting. And then out come the champions from the two sides, and then they have a duel, and then one side wins or the other. Like that in an English court, fighting with words against each other. That's the basis of all our legal system. It's not about mediation or arbitration or peaceful settling, as you have been traditionally in China. It's about winning and losing. Our politics is all about that. When you watch your current session of the Central Communist Party, we just sit around in England laughing. Because here you have all these people, Xi Jinping and these elderly men sitting in a row, and then thousands of people sitting there, and Xi Jinping and others are droning on. Thousands of people are just sitting, listening, trying not to go to sleep, because if you go to sleep, you go to prison. So, basically, as happened recently. So basically, there's no interaction, there's no struggle. If one of the people sitting near to Xi Jinping suddenly sprang up and said, "No, I don't agree with you," that would be the end of him. But you've seen, have any of you seen our House of Commons debates? You know, there's David Cameron, I'm the opposition here. I stand up and I say, "Oh, you're terrible, you're saying awful things." And then you stand up and say the same about me. We shout at each other, we disagree, we argue like this. And this is so combative and confrontational, even worse than the Americans. The Americans, you see, haven't taken up the system properly, nor have the Australians or the French or others, because they don't have a table like this. In America, they have a semicircle like this, and then people along that. So they don't have this proper democratic argumentative system. Only England has this. In Australia, they have that semicircle. And that way, you can't have a proper confrontation because people are not face to face like this in a row. So ours is an animal fight. When Fukuzawa, the same Fukuzawa I mentioned, went to the House of Commons and saw this, he was appalled. He said, this happened in Japan. People stood up and said, "I hate you, I would like you dead. I'd like all your friends dead." There would be a civil war in Japan. But he was amazed at all this shouting and bad language. But he was even more amazed because after they'd been shouting and saying, "I hate you," and so on, he watched them, and at the end of the debate, they all say, "Ah, you were pretty good. Come and have a drink." And this is the game. In other words, all of English civilization is best looked at as a game. It's a play. This is why our greatest playwright is a playwright, our greatest thinker in many ways. Shakespeare captures this. Life is a game or a play, and we are but actors in this play. It is full of sound and fury, signifying nothing, as he put it. So, we like to play the game, But at the end of the game, as long as you play by the rules and you play a fair game, it means nothing. For a time you create an inequality in the game, but at the end it doesn't change your opinion of the other side. This is what I had to learn in my schools. When I went to my schools, I used to often be very upset. I'd lose the game and I would cry and so on. But I had to learn that this is just a game. It doesn't matter. And you take this through your life. If you do not get promoted to be a professor, it's just a game. If you get beaten in an argument, you shouldn't take it too seriously. All of this is just a game. And the game is part of play, of playing, which is the central, one of the central cultural themes of the Anglosphere. Playing. Not only games, but above all in language. And above all within language, or in humour. If you look at our great writers, many of them, from Shakespeare to Dickens to Bernard Shaw to Oscar Wilde to Jane Austen, backwards and forwards, they are, and some of our great poets like Pope, they are wonderful manipulators of language. To use different kinds of humour, satire, irony, overstatement, understatement. Recently, in the last couple of years, I've been looking at my own education because I never throw anything away. So I have all my school essays and all my thoughts and diaries and bits and pieces for my whole education from early on. So I've been analysing these. And what amazed me is how much time I spent on learning to use language for humour. We were taught again and again how to use irony, how to use satire, how to make overstatement, understatement. The British middle class tricks in language are to do with jokes and humour. This is why our television humour is the best in the world, because it's a central obsession with this. You can tell how educated a person is in England by their use of humour. Above all, use of self-humour, so that, for instance, you should never overstate things, you should understate things, you should laugh at yourself. And you should use humour very delicately to prick, to undermine pomposity, too much power, and so on. So our great humorists are concerned with stopping people thinking too much of themselves and becoming too powerful. So our humorous television programmes, The Goons, Monty Python, Dad's Army, The League of Gentlemen, if you ever watch any of this, you'll see a very peculiar form of humour there. The British have a saying, if something awful happens to you in Britain, if you fall off your bicycle or get a very bad cold or someone throws all their garbage into your garden or Hitler drops a bomb in your back garden, you pick yourself up, you get a cup of tea, and you say, oh well, you've got to laugh. It's an English saying, you've got to laugh. Even if you don't feel like laughing, you've got to laugh. And so you've got to laugh at everything. The English and Americans laughed at Hitler. They laughed at Mussolini. We laugh at David Cameron. We laugh at our rulers. We laugh at our archbishops. No one is beyond laughter. So you've got to learn to laugh at Xi Jinping. When I see a satirical show in China, like the satirical shows we have against our politicians, making them into waxworks dummies, and showing their foolish sides and their pretensions. When I see that in China, I know you will be, you are a true democracy. So I hope one of you will one day do that and not end up in prison. So our humorous system is one of our great exports, along with language and so other things. So I will, I think, end there, that the anglosphere, because I want to draw it all together. Basically, you can learn a lot from the anglosphere. You can learn something about democracy, about freedom, about humour, about games, about all sorts of things. The rule of law, liberty, equality and fraternity. You can learn that we in the West live in a turbulent society which is rushing, contradictory, full of contradictions, never resolved. This is our message, really. I think Confucius was obviously one of the greatest thinkers of all time, but he never, I think, quite faced up to the fact that life is full of contradiction. He was so eager to make everything integrated and consensus that he didn't realize, as I think some of our great philosophers realized, that in fact there are basic contradictions built into being human which can never be resolved. All you can do is have a temporary compromise. You'll see it if you're interested in the poem, the first part of the poem of Alexander Pope on the Essay on Man, which ends in the first stanza. Created half to rise and half to fall. Great judge of all things as human beings, yet prone to endless error. The glory, jest, and riddle of the world. Human beings are half human, half above nature, half within nature. We're caught between the contradictions of our bodies and our minds, between death and life, and these can never really be fully reconciled. This is why Shakespeare is so wonderful, because he recognizes this, and his plays never resolve these problems, but they discuss them in various ways, as do our great poets and philosophers. So you have a great deal to learn from the Anglosphere as well as from Europe. But what you've got to do, and I'll go turn to this now, is somehow to absorb the best of all this without losing your own Chinese identity and all the contribution you can make through your long civilization. So I'll just go on for another 10 minutes and then give you one final short break and then we'll finish it. Comparing China, Japan, Europe, and the Anglosphere, one way you can compare them is in terms of geography. The West and the Anglosphere is a civilization based on water and huge varieties in small areas. China is much more uniform and is a land-based civilization and based in the south on rice. The process of the development of these four civilizations is very different. If you think of them as trees, China, as I say, is like a Genko tree. But this tree, historically, every 200, 300, 400 years is cut more or less at the roots. So, Qin Emperor, the Mongols, the Manchus, the terrible destructions of the 19th century, the communist cultural revolution, and so on. Each time a tree is cut right back, so there's nothing apparently there. 1978, Zhang Zemin, Liu China seemed to be dead. Family system gone, culture gone, Confucianism gone, nothing left. But what China does, and it was the same when the Mongols came and overran China, but what Chairman Mao didn't realize or couldn't do anything about, nor could the Mongols or the Manchus or anything else, is that the Genko tree has a huge roots on the ground, and also has a special system in the Genko where it can put out roots like this. And so very quickly it becomes the Genko tree again. It doesn't suddenly, with Chairman Mao or the Mongols, become something else.